Welcome. It's my, I'm Julie Owens, I'm a member for Parramatta, and it's my pleasure to introduce to you someone who you all no doubt you know all about already, Saul Eslake, a man with an extraordinary career over many decades in both the public and the private sector, involved in on the boards of the Australian Business Arts Foundation, Hydro Tasmania, the Tasmanian Arts Advisory Board, a member of the Australian Government's National Housing Supply Council, the Australian Statistics Advisory Council and the Tasmanian Premier's Digital Futures Advisory Council, on top of many other contributions he has made. He's going to talk to us today about and bring his extraordinary experience to some of the more interesting challenges that face Australia in the medium term. So it's my pleasure, without any more stuff from me, to introduce Saul Eslake.
Thank you, Ms. Owens, for the introduction, and thank you, everyone, for giving up what I'm sure is a part of a busy day in the parliamentary system to hear me talk, as I was invited to do by the Parliamentary Library, about tax reform, as I gather is what of is part of a series of talks that the Parliamentary Library is sponsoring ahead of the tax forum to be held later this month. When Machiavelli wrote, originally in 1515, that there is nothing more difficult to plan, more doubtful of success, nor more dangerous to manage than a new system, for the initiator has the enmity of all who would profit by the preservation of the old institutions and merely lukewarm defenders in those who'd gain by the new ones, he wasn't referring specifically to tax reform, but he might well have been. That's because once a taxation system's been around for any length of time, it's inevitable that some of its characteristics, most notably the favourable treatment which it confers on particular forms of income or expenditure relative to others, or on particular types of business organisation relative to others, or on particular categories of investment or economic activity relative to others, will become capitalised into prices, or will in some other way have become valuable in their own right. And those who've derived some benefit relative to others from those characteristics of the taxation system will be staunch and unremitting in their defence of them, while those who've gained little or nothing from them, or who have indeed been disadvantaged in some way by them, though more numerous, will tend to say little. I was actually surprised to have received an invitation to attend next month's tax forum, since those whose task it was to determine who received invitations must surely have been aware that I would want to talk about some of the things that the government would prefer that no one did, such as the base and rate of the goods and services tax, the tax status of income paid by superannuation funds to people over 60, and negative gearing. So I want to acknowledge Treasurer Wayne Swan's generosity of spirit in nonetheless inviting me to the tax forum. My point of departure for any discussion of tax reform is the canons of good tax design that were first laid out by Adam Smith in 1774, namely, in his words, one, that the subjects of every state ought to contribute towards the support of government as nearly as possible in proportion to their respective abilities, that is, in proportion to the revenue which they respectively enjoy under the protection of the state. Two, the tax which the individual is bound to pay ought to be certain and not arbitrary. The time of payment, the manner of payment, the quantity to be paid ought all to be clear and plain to the contributor and to every other person. Three, every tax ought to be levied at the time or in the manner in which it's most likely to be convenient for the contributor to pay it. And four, every tax ought to be so contrived as to take out of the pockets as little as possible over and above that which it brings into the public treasury of the state. That is, in my words rather than his, the taxation system should ideally be equitable as between taxpayers and certain in its impact on them, simple to comply with and parsimonious in its costs of administration and collection. As Neil Warren showed in his lecture here last week, these principles have been endorsed and upheld by a succession of inquiries into and official pronouncements upon the Australian taxation system over the last 35 years. I would add to Adam Smith's canons two other principles which seem to me to make sense in today's time. Five, the taxation system should neither preference nor penalise some types of income or expenditure, some categories of citizens or taxpayers, some forms of business organisation, or some saving or investment vehicles over others, unless there is a clearly stated public policy rationale for doing so. And six, the taxation system should have regard to the possible consequences, including for the level of investment, labour force participation and economic activity, and for the amount of revenue collected, of substantial differences between Australia's taxation system and the taxation systems of other countries with which Australia has significant or potentially significant economic interactions. That is, the taxation system should also ideally be as far as possible neutral as between the choices that taxpayers make as to how they earn and spend their income, how they constitute their businesses, and how and where they choose to invest their capital, unless there is some clear public policy objective served by having the taxation system treat some particular category of spending or form of economic activity favourably or unfavourably. For example, in the case of tobacco products, alcoholic beverages, gambling, or in the case of tax breaks for long-term savings for retirement. And the tax system should have some regard to considerations of international competitiveness and the possible effects of significant differences between our tax system and that of other countries on our capacity to attract or retain human or financial capital. Which isn't to say that there should be no such divergences, but simply that we should be aware of any possible consequences that such divergences may have, and be sure that those consequences are outweighed by the benefits as we see them of those divergences. I don't propose to say anything today about the overall level of taxation in Australia. It's well known that by comparison with other OECD countries, Australia's total taxation collections are very low. According to the most recent compilation, taxes amounted to 27.1% of Australia's GDP in 2008, lower than all but five other countries in the OECD. The US and Korea, for whom the proportion of GDP collected in tax was less than one percentage point lower than in Australia, and three of the OECD's least developed countries, Turkey, Chile and Mexico. Australia's 27.1% tax to GDP ratio is also well below the unweighted OECD average of 34.8%. In passing, I'd note that the proportion of GDP collected in tax by governments in the US in 2008 was some 13 percentage points below the level of spending by those governments as a share of GDP in that year. So the commonly made comparison between Australian and US taxes is hardly one between apples and apples. I'd also note that if you add to official taxation collections some of the payments which are made more or less compulsorily by households for purposes which in many other OECD countries are funded through taxes, such as employer superannuation contributions which amounted to 5.75% of GDP in 2007-08, or private health insurance premiums which were just over 1% of GDP, then the resulting total of those things plus taxes actually isn't significantly below the OECD average. So I conclude that there's no compelling case, based on comparisons with other OECD countries at least, that the total level of taxation collected by Australian governments, on average over the course of the business cycle, should be either much lower or much higher than it is at present. But I would argue that Australia's taxation system departs in some cases egregiously from all of the principles of good tax design that I spelled out a few moments ago. I've said on other occasions that if you were the newly installed treasurer or finance minister of some newly independent nation, and that for some reason you hired a consultant to advise you how to create a taxation system that encouraged the accumulation of wealth through borrowing and speculating, whilst penalising the accumulation of wealth through working and saving, the consultant would hand you a copy of the Income Tax Assessment Act, because that's precisely what Australia's income tax system actually does. It imposes the highest rates on wage and salary income, that is income from working, and income from the most common forms of saving, bank, building, society and credit union deposits, whilst by contrast taxing income from investments other than deposits at substantially lower rates than identical amounts of income when derived from working. And if those investments are wholly or partially funded by debt, it provides a subsidy which serves to reduce the amount of tax payable on the income from those investments even further. For most people on relatively high wage or salary incomes, tax rates aren't as high as they used to be as a result of the substantial increases in the thresholds at which the top rate becomes payable that were implemented during the last term of the Howard government. However, for people lower down the income scale, The interaction of the income tax system with income tests on various forms of social security payments can result in them facing effective marginal rates considerably above those paid by those earning the highest incomes, in some cases over 60% according to the Henry Review. These high effective marginal tax rates can, and according to at least some research do, adversely affect the willingness of some people, especially women with children, to enter paid employment. By contrast, the Australian income tax system provides substantial incentives for people to borrow in order to acquire property, shares or other assets whose value they expect to increase over time. Unlike in most other countries, it's always been possible in Australia to deduct any excess of interest payments on loans taken out to fund an investment over the income produced by that investment in order to reduce the tax payable on other wage and salary income. I'll say more about negative gearing later on in this talk, but for now I simply wish to make the point that a tax system which imposes its highest effective rates of tax on the income of relatively modestly paid workers and on the form of saving most commonly used by people on relatively modest incomes, whilst providing de facto subsidies to investment vehicles most commonly used by people on relatively high incomes, can hardly be considered either equitable or neutral. A tax system which over two-thirds of taxpayers feel they can't comply with without the assistance of an agent, a higher proportion than any other OECD country with the exception of Italy, could hardly be considered simple or, for that matter, certain in its impact. And taxes such as the GST, which costs the tax office $1.36 to collect for every $100 of revenue raised, compared with 94 cents on average for other taxes, can hardly be considered parsimonious in their costs of collection and administration. And that's without taking account of the costs incurred by taxpayers themselves, as distinct from the ATO. So if idealism has any meaning at all, there's a compelling case for further substantial reform of the Australian taxation system. And of course, the Henry Review made precisely such a case. Of course, idealism doesn't get you very far in Australian politics these days. And as I observed at the beginning of this talk with a quote from Machiavelli's The Prince, it's particularly applicable in the context of tax reform, since it's by definition impossible to do tax reform, as distinct from providing tax cuts, without creating losers as well as winners. And the Australian political system and the Australian media nowadays give much greater prominence to the concerns of losers, whether deserving or undeserving, from any public policy change than they do to those of winners, as I learnt, for example, in a different context from more than 5 years of presiding over the distribution of grants to arts organisations in Tasmania. In addition, it's not possible at the moment, nor is it likely to be possible in the next few years, for governments to do tax reform in the way that the Howard government did it in 2000, by drawing on a big fat budget surplus to overcompensate massively those who would otherwise be adversely affected by proposed tax reforms. And that presumably is one of the reasons why the Treasurer has ruled out consideration of some of the things that I personally think should be on the agenda at next month's tax forum, and also why when Shadow Treasurer Joe Hockey earlier this year proposed some other things that should be part of any serious discussion of tax reforms, such as the tax status of trusts, he was promptly slapped down by a number of his colleagues and by his parliamentary leader. Nonetheless, since I think these are things that should be on the tax reform agenda, and because I probably won't get the chance to talk about them at the tax forum, I'm going to talk about some of them now. It does seem to me particularly extraordinary that consideration of the rate and base of the GST should be completely verboten by both sides of politics. It was the coalition that brought it in originally, and they wanted to impose it on a broader base than it is at present. And the Labor Party's fraternal colleagues in Europe, where value-added tax, or VAT as it's known in that part of the world, was specifically devised by social democratic parties in order to pay for the Western European welfare state, they seem perfectly happy to preside over GSTs that impose rates of no less than 15% anywhere in Western Europe, in most cases of at least 20%, and in three cases as high as 25%. It's true, as I noted earlier, that the GST is expensive to collect. But its relatively high collection costs are in large part the result of the boundary issues that arise from the exemptions from it. The need to determine whether, as Justice Richard Edmonds of the Federal Court pointed out earlier this month, Italian mini ciabatta is a cracker and therefore subject to the GST, or bread and therefore exempt from it. New Zealand's GST has almost no exemptions and it's much cheaper to administer. As the Henry Review pointed out, a narrower GST does not make it fairer, but it does add complexity. The highest income fifth of Australian households spend almost six times as much on GST-free food as the lowest income quintile. As a result, more than one third of the $6 billion of revenue foregone as a result of the exemption of food from the GST benefits households in the top 20% of the income distribution. Moreover, the exemption of some 40% of total, that is household and government, consumption from the GST is adding to the financial pressures facing state and territory governments as a result of the significant slowing in consumer spending growth in recent years. As this year's budget papers note, expenditure on items subject to the GST is declining both as a share of GDP and as a share of consumer spending, in part because prices of goods and services not subject to the GST have been rising at a faster rate than prices of goods and services which are subject to the GST. If those trends continue, and it's hard to think of compelling reasons why they won't, it would seem inevitable that the federal government is going to have to increase the rate or base of the GST or both at some stage, or that state and territory governments will have to jack up the limited number of narrow and inefficient taxes under their control in order to ensure that waiting lists at public hospitals, class sizes in public schools and crowding on public transport don't increase beyond politically acceptable limits. And really, the choice between those two options is surely a no-brainer. And as the government's now doing with its proposed carbon tax, it's perfectly possible to compensate those lower income households who would be adversely impacted by an increase in the rate or base of the GST through income tax or transfer payments. Among the more egregious instances of how the Australian taxation system departs from principles of good tax design such as fairness and simplicity, and I would argue also departs needlessly from considerations of international competitiveness, is the way in which it allows the costs associated with financing and investment to be offset not only against the income produced by that investment, but also against other income through what's popularly known in this country as negative gearing. It's perhaps a telling indication of just how generous the Australian tax system is to investors in this regard compared with other countries, that you usually need to explain to foreigners what the term negative gearing actually means, because most other countries don't have it. Negative gearing originally allowed taxpayers, in effect, to defer tax on their wage and salary income until they sold the property or shares which they'd acquired with borrowed money, on which they were paying more in interest than they received by way of dividends or rent. However, after the Howard government's 1999 decision to tax capital gains at half the rate applicable to other income, instead of taxing inflation-adjusted gains at a taxpayer's full marginal rate, negative gearing became a vehicle for reducing as well as deferring tax liabilities. And the availability of depreciation on buildings, even though the value of buildings normally goes up, adds to the way in which negative gearing converts ordinary income taxable at full rates into capital gains taxable later on at half rates. It's therefore hardly surprising that negative gearing has become much more widespread over the past decade and much more costly in terms of the revenue foregone. In 1998-99, when capital gains were last taxed at the same rate as other types of income, Australia had 1.3 million tax-paying landlords, who in total made a taxable profit of $700 million. By 2008-09, the latest year for which statistics are presently available, the number of tax-paying landlords had risen to just under 1.7 million, a higher proportion of Australian households than the corresponding proportion in any other Western economy. But they collectively lost over $6.5 billion, largely because the amount they paid out in interest rose almost fourfold from over $5 billion to almost $20 billion over that period, while the amount they collected in rent only slightly more than doubled from $11 billion to $26 billion, as did other non-interest expenses. If all of the 1.1 million landlords who in total reported net losses in 2008-09 were in the 38% income tax bracket, their ability to offset those losses against their other taxable income would have cost over $4.3 billion in revenue foregone. If, say, one-fifth of them had been in the top tax bracket, then the cost of revenue would have been over $4.6 billion. And that's a pretty large subsidy from people who are working and saving to people who are borrowing and speculating, since these landlords who are making running losses on their property investments expect to more than make up those losses through capital gains when they're ultimately sold. And it's hard to think of any worthwhile public policy purpose which is served by that subsidy. It certainly does nothing to increase the supply of housing, since the vast majority of landlords buy established properties rather than new ones. 92% of all borrowing by residential property investors over the past decade has been for the purchase of established dwellings, as distinct from 82% of all borrowing by owner-occupiers. Precisely for that reason, the availability of negative gearing contributes to upward pressure on the prices of established dwellings, and thus diminishes housing affordability for would-be home buyers. Supporters of negative gearing argue that its abolition would lead to a landlord strike, driving up rents and exacerbating the existing shortage of affordable rental housing. They repeatedly point to what they allege happened when the Hawke government abolished negative gearing only for property investment in 1986, that it led to a surge in rents, which prompted the reintroduction of negative gearing in 1988. This assertion is actually not true. If the abolition of negative gearing had led to a landlord strike, as proponents of negative gearing repeatedly assert, then rents should have risen everywhere since negative gearing had been available everywhere. In fact, rents as measured in the CPI only rose rapidly at double-digit rates in Sydney and Perth. And that was because in those two cities, rental vacancy rates were unusually low, in Sydney's case barely above 1%, before negative gearing was abolished. In other state capitals where vacancy rates were higher, growth in rentals was either unchanged after the abolition of negative gearing, or in Melbourne, it actually declined. However, notwithstanding this history, suppose that a large number of landlords were to respond to the abolition of negative gearing by selling their properties. That would push down the price of investment properties, making them more affordable to would-be homebuyers, allowing more of them to become homeowners, and thereby reducing the demand for rental properties in almost exactly the same proportion as the reduction in the supply of them. It's actually quite difficult to think of anything that would do more to improve housing affordability conditions for would-be homebuyers than the abolition of negative gearing. It would certainly do more than continuing to give large amounts of cash to would-be first-home buyers through grants or stamp duty concessions, which historically have served only to increase the price of existing dwellings and thus ending up in the pockets of existing vendors. There's no evidence to support the assertion made by proponents of the continued existence of negative gearing that it results in more rental housing being available than would be the case if it were to be abolished, even though the Henry Review appears to have swallowed that assertion. Most other advanced economies, as I said, don't have negative gearing. Yes, most other countries have higher rental vacancy rates than Australia does. In the United States, which doesn't allow negative gearing, the rental vacancy rate has in the last 50 years only once been below 5%, and that was in the March quarter of 1979. In the 10 years prior to the onset of the most recent recession, it averaged 9.1%. Yet here in Australia, which does allow negative gearing, the rental vacancy rate has never in the last 30 years been above 5%, and in the period since negative gearing became more attractive as a result of the halving of the capital gains tax rate, it's fallen from over 3% to less than 2%. During that same period, rents rose at a rate 0.8 percentage points per annum faster than the CPI as a whole, whereas over the preceding decade, rents rose at exactly the same rate as the CPI. Now, I'm not actually advocating that negative gearing be abolished for property investments only, as happened between 86 and 88. That was and would be unfair to property investors. Personally, I think negative gearing should be abolished for all investors, so that interest expenses would only be deductible in any given year up to the amount of investment income earned in that year, with any excess carried forward against the ultimate capital gains tax liability, rather than being used to reduce the tax payable on other wage and salary income, as is the case in the United States and most other advanced economies. But I'd settle for the recommendation of the Henry Review, which was that only 40% of interest and other expenses associated with investments be allowed as a deduction, and that capital gains and other forms of investment income, including interest on deposits, be taxed at a 60% rather than 50% as at present of the rates applicable to the same amounts of wage and salary income. This recommendation would not amount to the abolition of negative gearing. It would just make it less generous than it is at the moment. It would be likely, as the Henry Review suggested, to change investor demand towards housing with higher rental yields and longer investment horizons, and may result in a more stable housing market as the current incentive for investors to chase large capital gains in housing would be reduced. I could even accept the Henry Review's recommendations that these reforms should only be adopted following reforms to the supply of housing and reforms to housing assistance, which it makes elsewhere, even though, as I've argued earlier, I disagree with the Henry Review's concern that these reforms may in the short term reduce residential property investment. There are over 270,000 trusts in Australia. People use them for all sorts of purposes, including the smooth transfer of business assets, particularly those used in primary production, from one generation of owners to the next, protecting assets from vengeful ex-spouses and other aggrieved relatives, and so on. And there's nothing illegitimate about that. However, the use of trusts also often confers significant tax advantages, particularly by allowing income to be split among family members, although the most recent budget significantly reduced the opportunity to divert income to dependent children. Although the Howard government gave serious consideration to taxing trusts as companies, and more recently Joe Hockey advocated the same idea, the Henry Review was surprisingly lukewarm towards this and other propositions to reduce the tax advantages which can be availed of by people who operate their business activities through trusts. In particular, the Henry Review's assertion that further limiting the opportunities to alienate savings income through trusts would have potential downsides for the overall progressivity of the tax system and for other taxpayers is hard to understand, and the review doesn't give any reasons for it. Nor is it all clear why the review thought that taxing trusts as companies would be poorly targeted. I remain of the view that no tax advantages should accrue to users of trusts, and that's despite the fact that I now have one myself, and that the existence of trusts should be of no effect for tax purposes. Changing the tax system to that end would have no impact on the ability of people to use trusts for entirely legitimate purposes, but it would enhance the fairness and integrity of the tax system. In my view, one of the worst taxation decisions made in the last 20 years, and there's a fair bit of competition for this offer, was the decision announced in the 2006 budget to exempt entirely from income tax superannuation benefits paid to people aged 60 and over. This was presented at the time as a dramatic simplification of the tax system as it applies to superannuation, and as an incentive to continue working at older ages. Again, I should note in passing that this is a decision from which I expect and intend to benefit personally in due course. Coming after the introduction of the so-called Senior Australians Tax Offset, which allows people of pension age to pay less tax on a given amount of income than younger people for no reason other than that they are of pension age. Clearly, both sides of politics think there are votes to be had in providing tax breaks for older folks, since both these measures were introduced by the Coalition, while the present government explicitly precluded the Henry Review from even considering the tax-free status of superannuation payments to 60 and overs, although that didn't stop the review from observing that income from work should be taxed on a more consistent basis, whether it comes from wages and salaries, fringe benefits, or superannuation contributions, and noting that superannuation benefits from a tax source for people aged 60 and over are not directly from work but have similar characteristics. In other words, they sort of got there, notwithstanding the terms of reference. And that they added that the Senior Australians Tax Offset should be removed and replaced as a transitional measure with an offset that takes account of their proposed new scales, and that this new offset should be reduced over time. But I can think of no legitimate public policy objective, as distinct from base political motives, which justify some people paying less tax than others on the same amount of income purely because of their age. And I would add that the cost of these tax breaks for old folks will continue to increase over time as a result of demographic change, thereby increasing the burden on other taxpayers. That's not to say that I'm opposed to simplification of the way in which superannuation savings are taxed, nor am I against superannuation savings being preferentially taxed relative to other forms of saving, because encouraging greater self-provision for retirement and the growth of pools of patient capital are legitimate public policy objectives which will do good for the economy. But I don't believe it's necessary for the tax system to be as generous as it currently is, especially to high-income earners like me, in order to achieve those legitimate public policy objectives. I think there's a very good argument on fairness grounds for converting the 15% rate currently applicable to superannuation contributions and earnings by superannuation funds into a 15% rebate on the tax otherwise payable at each taxpayer's marginal rate on income earned in those forms. One of the few recommendations of the Henry Review which was taken up immediately, or at least at the same time as the review was released, having been kept under wraps for almost 6 months by the Rudd government, was that for a resource rent tax, which Kevin Rudd, in keeping with his love for acronyms, dubbed the RSPT, or Resources Super Profits Tax. This proposal was, in my view, poorly conceived, in particular because it relied on the commercially unrealistic assumption that financiers would regard as credible a government promise to repay investors for 40% of their stake in failed mining ventures in exchange for taking, in addition to the company tax ordinarily payable, a 40% share of the profits of successful ones. That would have required financiers to believe that amidst a slump in commodity prices, the most plausible scenario under which there'd be a whole lot of failed mining ventures, when the government would likely be running a large deficit, it would willingly add to that deficit by handing over billions of dollars to investors in failed mining projects. I think that's less likely than that Tasmania will get its own team in the Australian Football League while Andrew Demetrio remains its CEO, than that a future government would honour a promise in such circumstances. But the principle underlying the Henry Review's recommendation, namely that the return to the Australian people from the exploitation of mineral and energy resources should be based on the profits derived from the extraction and sale of those resources rather than on the volume of resource production, is one that I and most other economists strongly support. And I think it's regrettable that in the backlash against the poorly conceived and badly sold RSPT, the government has backed down to the point of imposing tax at barely more than half the rate initially proposed and will apply it only to two minerals, coal and iron ore. Why, for example, shouldn't gold mining be brought within this taxation regime now that gold is trading at not far below $2,000 an ounce? I would have thought there are two other proposals that could usefully be considered here. The first would be simply to extend the existing petroleum resource rent tax arrangements, which have applied to offshore oil and gas projects since the 1980s, and which clearly haven't acted as a deterrent to what's become a very substantial amount of investment in the oil and gas sector, to onshore mining ventures. The second would simply to stipulate that for as long as the mining boom lasts, and it would be possible to define that in terms of the Reserve Bank's commodity price index or the terms of trade, being above some prescribed level such as its value in the 2004-05 financial year, the company tax rate on income from mining will be, say, 33%, and perhaps the company tax rate on income from all other activities will be, say, 27%, or whatever combination of higher and lower rates than the current 30% produces a revenue-neutral outcome. There's a precedent for this in the exemption that applied to income from gold mining from the 1930s until the early 1990s. If it's possible to apply a tax rate of zero to income from a particular form of mining, and a different rate to company income from all other sources, then surely it's possible to impose one tax rate on income from mining of all types, and a different rate on income from all other sources. There's also a precedent in the present government's proposal to apply a lower rate of company tax to small companies than to big ones, a proposal which, incidentally, I don't support. I don't see any legitimate public policy reason why small businesses should pay tax at a lower rate than large ones, any more than I can see a legitimate public policy reason why old people should pay tax at a lower rate than young ones. It's possible that mining companies could seek to avoid a higher rate of company tax by conducting profitable non-mining activities through other entities and through other forms of transfer pricing, e.g. attributing to their mining businesses costs which are actually incurred for other purposes. However, I don't see that it would be any greater a problem with this than it is with company tax more generally. And the ATO already has various tools available to monitor the incidence of transfer pricing and respond where it has grounds to believe that avoidance is taking place. I think that either of these approaches would be both more practical and more saleable than the minerals resource rent tax which the government's now proposing. The last specific area I want to discuss today is that of state taxes. As Australia's second Prime Minister, Alfred Deakin, predicted almost 110 years ago, the Constitution and the way that it's been interpreted by the High Court left the states legally free but financially bound to the chariot wheels of the central government. The states and territories' revenue-raising capacities fall short of their expenditure responsibilities by a margin that has few, if any, parallels in other federations. Moreover, the taxes which the states and territories are constitutionally able to impose are, for the most part, ones which fall foul of almost all of the principles of good tax design that I mentioned at the beginning of this talk. Of course, the states and territories haven't helped their situation by mismanaging the tax powers which they do have. In the case of payroll tax, their largest own revenue source they have for most of the period since it was transferred to them by the McMahon government in the early 70s, narrowed the base in order to favour curry with small business owners and raised the rate in order to offset the loss of revenue that would otherwise have resulted, the opposite of what good tax reform should be about. States and territories have similarly narrowed the base of stamp duties and land tax, the second and third largest revenue sources, in order to curry favour with first home buyers and homeowners more generally, thereby, I might add, adding to upward pressure on house prices, since these tax breaks invariably get capitalised into the price of land, without doing anything to increase home ownership rates and necessitating higher rates of tax on those not so favoured. States and territories gave away death duties in the late 70s and 80s in what ultimately amounted to a zero-sum game for each state and territory was concerned, but deprived all states and territories of a tax source that meets most of the aforementioned criteria except that of simplicity. And states and territories have never actively pursued regaining the income tax powers of which they were stripped temporarily for wartime purposes in the 1940s. I don't actually have the same concern with payroll taxes as many others. Australian payroll taxes are lower than the payroll taxes of, or as they're called in Europe, social security taxes, that typically fund all or part of many OECD countries' pension or healthcare systems. And despite their allegedly adverse effects on job creation, they haven't prevented Australia from attaining and remaining pretty close to full employment in recent years. However, I agree with the Henry Review, among others, that stamp duties and insurance taxes are very bad taxes. Although they're relatively simple and certain to collect, they offend almost all of the other principles of good tax design. Stamp duties in particular discourage the construction of new dwellings and inhibit people from moving location in order to obtain new or better employment, and hence detract from the efficiency of the labour market. They're also inequitable as they result in people with similar incomes and wealth paying different amounts of tax because they buy and sell a taxed good more or less frequently. Finally, because they're taxes on the volume of transactions, the revenue from them is highly volatile, and they can lead state and territory governments into unsustainable fiscal positions. I think there's a strong case based on the principles of good tax design for abolishing stamp duties entirely and replacing them with a more broadly based land tax that includes owner-occupied properties and which could be collected by local governments in exchange for a small commission, thereby allowing state governments to abolish their revenue offices if they also outsource the collection of payroll tax to the ATO. Low-income occupiers, such as retirees, could be catered for by allowing them to defer land taxes as a charge against their estates, as some local governments do already with municipal rates. Although you can imagine the howls of protests from the would-be inheritors of otherwise unencumbered properties at that suggestion. Obviously, there'd need to be some transitional arrangements for those who recently purchased properties and paid stamp duty on them to ensure that they weren't unfairly taxed twice, but that wouldn't be too difficult to devise. State and territory insurance taxes are high by international standards and, according to the Henry Review, are one of the least efficient taxes available to the states. They encourage underinsurance, and to the extent that lower income households are more likely to underinsure, they're inequitable for that reason. Where they're used to fund fire or ambulance services, they're also unfair in the sense that those who take out the form of insurance subject to the tax for that purpose in effect subsidise those who choose not to, without there being any public policy rationale for that kind of cross-subsidy. However, they do raise nearly $5 billion in revenue for state and territory governments. The best way to pay for their abolition would be as part of a reform package incorporating a broader base and or an increase in the rate of GST. One final point I want to make under the heading of state taxes is to express dismay at the prospect of substantial changes to the way in which the revenues from the GST are carved up among the states and territories. The Gillard government obviously expects the review which it's commissioned of those arrangements to recommend changes which will favour the larger states. Otherwise, it wouldn't have appointed to conduct it a former premier of each of the two larger states, both of whom are on the record as favouring changes which would benefit New South Wales and Victoria, balanced only by an accountant from Adelaide. Yet, I would have thought that if the government really believes that it's important to ensure the benefits of the mining boom are widely shared, that as Wayne Swan put it in the third sentence of his budget speech, national prosperity reaches more lives in more corners of our patchwork economy, then the last thing it should be contemplating is making fundamental changes to a system which in effect redistributes income from rich states to poor ones. Nor do I understand what it is about such a system that's so troubling to a Labor government, which one might have thought believed almost instinctively that redistributing income from rich to poor is a good thing. I readily acknowledge that Australia takes the practice of horizontal fiscal equalisation much further than other federal systems. But that's one of the reasons why the difference in living standards between Tasmania and Western Australia is a lot less than the corresponding difference between, say, Mississippi and Connecticut, or Newfoundland and Alberta, something from which I would have thought most Australians, not only Tasmanians, would draw some comfort. I think it's particularly galling to see Western Australia, which for most of the 78 years since the Grants Commission was established after they voted to secede from the Commonwealth, and which has been a beneficiary of those recommendations for most of those 78 years, at the forefront of demands for changes to these arrangements now that it's become a net contributor to the GST pool rather than a net beneficiary. Western Australia's attitude is a bit like that of a pensioner who's won the lottery and then complains about losing his pension and having to pay income tax. There's never been a principle that says that a state or territory is entitled to all of the revenue from a particular form of taxation raised by the Commonwealth government within that state or territory's borders, any more than there is an expectation that state or territory governments will spend the revenues from payroll or land taxes or stamp duties on land transfers in the local government areas from which they are collected. The Western Australian government in particular doesn't adhere to that principle on its own turf. Since coming to office, the Barnett government has, at the behest of its junior partner, the WA Nationals, had a policy called Royalties for Regents, under which 25% of the income from mining royalties is paid into a fund which is in turn spent on infrastructure, strategic regional and community services projects, and the provision of contestable grant funding. But even though 80% of those royalties come from the Pilbara, in the north of the state, there's absolutely no requirement that 80% of the money spent through the Royalties for Regions program be spent there, and it isn't. A good proportion of it is spent in the WA Nationals heartland to the south and southeast of Perth. So it's the height of hypocrisy for the Western Australian government to demand that it's entitled to any fixed percentage of the GST revenue collected west of the 129th parallel. I noted earlier that it would be very difficult to achieve much, if anything, by way of meaningful or substantial tax reform in the near term, because of the seemingly much greater political difficulties nowadays associated with pursuing any reform that creates losers as well as winners, and because of the absence of a fat surplus that can be used to overcompensate the losers. Nonetheless, it's perhaps worth reminding ourselves that of what could be at stake if Australia doesn't achieve substantial and meaningful tax reform over the medium term. First, the likelihood is that our tax system will become increasingly dysfunctional in the absence of meaningful reform. According to the projections contained in this year's budget papers, by 2014-15, the various forms of income taxes, company, personal, RRT, FBT and superannuation fund taxes, will account for 74.7% of total Commonwealth tax collections. That's the highest ever recorded, and up from less than 70% in the years immediately after the last major round of tax reforms in 2000, one of whose explicit objectives was to shift the tax mix from direct to indirect taxation. Within that total, personal income tax will account for 47.7% of total Commonwealth tax collections, the highest since 2002, before the Howard government began cutting personal income taxes in each of its last five budgets. This is likely to generate significant political pressure for income tax cuts later on in the decade, at a time when such tax cuts would likely to be unwise on broader macroeconomic policy grounds. Over the same period, GST revenues are expected to continue to decline to less than 3.3% of GDP, half of a percentage point less than their peak in the years 2002-03 through 2004-05. That's likely to put further pressure on the finances of state and territory governments, especially those of the smaller states and the territories, which are more dependent on GST revenues than the larger states. Second, as I've argued in other places, Australia has a productivity problem. Over the past decade, labour productivity growth has averaged just 1.5% per annum, down from 2.1% in the 90s, while multi-factor productivity growth has slowed from 1.6% per annum during the 90s to zero over the past decade and to minus 1% per annum in the last 5 years. As a result, as Treasury Secretary Martin Parkinson noted earlier this year, the rate of improvement in the living standards of Australians, at least that part measured by incomes, has already begun to deteriorate, even with the sustained and unprecedented rise in the terms of trade. If this productivity slump were to continue, then once the current mining boom comes to an end, whenever that might be, the rate at which Australians' living standards continue to improve will slow more sharply and could perhaps even turn negative. The causes of this productivity slowdown are complex, and there are no simple solutions to it. But tax reform can certainly play a role in reversing it, not least by removing distortions and reducing deadweight losses associated with the existing structure of taxes, and by encouraging the movement of labour and capital into activities more capable of generating faster rates of productivity growth, rather than into areas which attract favourable tax treatment. The Henry Review estimated that its four major proposed reforms could lift output by 2 to 3 percentage points, or $25 to $40 billion in today's prices. Third, the distribution of income and wealth in Australia has become less egalitarian over the last decade. Not by nearly as much as in the United States, or for that matter, and somewhat ironically, in the People's Republic of China, but nonetheless by enough to warrant some consideration in the context of any discussion about tax reform. According to data released this month by the ABS, the share of household disposable income accruing to the top fifth of the income distribution has increased by 1.8 percentage points over the 10 years to 2009-10 to 40.2%, while the share accruing to the bottom two quintiles, the bottom 40% of the income distribution, has fallen by 0.5 percentage points to 19.5%. The share of household net worth owned by households in the top quintile of the wealth distribution has increased by 3.4 percentage points to 62.4% since 2003-04, the last survey of that nature. While the share of net worth owned by the bottom two quintiles has fallen by 0.8 percentage points to 6.3%. And changes to the tax system have played some role in these trends. Although the wealthiest fifth of households pay a higher proportion of their income in tax, 18%, than households lower down the wealth distribution, that proportion paid by the highest quintile by wealth in tax has fallen by more than that for households in any other quintile since 2003-04, by 4.2 percentage points, compared with 4.1 percentage points for households in the second highest wealth quintile, and by between 2.5 and 3.6 percentage points for households in the bottom three quintiles. I've never been, am not now, and almost certainly never will be a socialist in the traditional sense of that term, one who places an absolute priority on achieving greater equality in the distribution of income and wealth. But I'm also conscious that widening inequalities of income and wealth distribution beyond some point can have adverse economic as well as social consequences, including, as we've seen in the United States over the past two decades, unsustainable increases in the level of household debt, as households whose incomes have stagnated or declined in real terms, while those of a tiny minority have continued to grow apace, borrow in an attempt to maintain levels of consumer spending that their incomes can no longer support. So, in addition to the observation that the Australian taxation system falls foul of almost all of the widely accepted principles of good tax design, arguments about the sustainability and shape of Australia's revenue-raising system, the need to reverse the slump in Australia's productivity growth, and concerns arising from the greater polarisation in the distribution of income and wealth, to me, add up to a very good case for putting fundamental tax reform on the agenda now. Whether arguments such as these can serve as sufficient reason for political leaders to put substantial and meaningful tax reform back on the political agenda remains to be seen. Sadly, I'm not holding my breath. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to hear you speak. Do you have time for some questions?
Absolutely, yeah.
We can take some questions. It's my job to make sure we're out of here by 1:30, but we have 10 minutes, so questions from the floor? Otherwise, we'll be out.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll ask a question. I was interested regarding comments that the US doesn't have negative gearing, but you can deduct your income of that property to the level of cost of holding it. And you suggest that would be a good thing for Australia to modify our negative gearing to something similar to that. Would it be possible to give to the private home buyer some similar sort of advantage so as to create a level playing field for the homeowner as for the investor?
I would say yes, only and if and only if you also expose the homeowner to capital gains tax on any increase in the value of the home. Indeed, if you chose the latter, you would have to do the former as an expense of earning the income, which would then be subject to tax. The problem I would see with it is, given where house prices are now, the likelihood that there will be substantial capital gains from now, assuming you wouldn't make the capital gains tax retrospective, I'm certainly not advocating that, that there would be actually pretty small probability of capital gains that could be taxed, but a very high probability of greater deductions from income tax because of interest. And moreover, the history of the way Australians respond to changes in the effective price of debt is that when the price of debt falls, as it's done over the early 1990s, Australians don't respond to that by saying, good, I can now spend a smaller proportion of my income servicing the debt that I was prepared to take out. What they do is they say, oh goody, I can take out a bigger amount of debt by spending the same proportion of my income servicing it, and that's a big part of the house price inflation we've had over the last 20 years. So my guess is that if you made interest on owner-occupied housing tax deductible, what would happen is that people would borrow even more money than they are doing now and push prices up. Now that might generate some capital gains for you subsequently, but my guess is that overall the system would, if you did that, A, it would be revenue negative, and B, it would encourage households to take out even more debt than they presently have, and I don't think that would be a good thing.
But for a stimulus to allow first home buyers to actually get a home, a and contain it to that possibly?
Well, again, the likelihood of them doing that would be that they would borrow more money than they otherwise would and bid up the price of housing just as they do with first-time owner grants. I mean, there's plenty of evidence, including most spectacularly in the 18 months or so after the global financial crisis, that that elevated level of grants that was given, I mean, defensively, in my view, for construction of new housing, totally indefensibly for the purchase of established housing, all that that did was increase the price of established housing. Now, granted, we brought forward some construction of new housing, and that was a good thing, because that was a form of stimulus at a time when the housing industry needed it. But bearing in mind that most of the first-time buyers, and even more of investors, but most first-time buyers buy an established housing, if you give them money to do it, all they're doing is pushing up the price of that housing by the amount of the grant. And, you know, I would argue, if you have to do this at all, if you have to do it at all, then it should be confined to people who buy new housing, and there should be a price limit on the housing that qualifies for a grant. And ironically, when these schemes were first introduced in 1963, by the Menzies government, interestingly, as a piece of history, at the instigation of the New South Wales branch of the Young Liberals, whose president at the time was John Howard, they were confined to people who, A, were under the age of 35, B, were married, C, proposed to buy a new house, D, were subject to an income tax, and E, had a requirement that they had saved $600 per annum over the previous 3 years. Now, I would certainly never argue that government assistance should be confined to people on their marital status, but I think all the other qualities, all the other criteria associated with the original home savings grant scheme, if you have to have one, and I think they're a chronic waste of money, but if you have to have one, all the other criteria associated with the original one would be worth reintroducing.
So in terms of the principles of good taxation you outlined at the beginning, in transparency and certainty, there's two that I recall, how do you equate that with the distribution of GST to the different states?
Well, I think the existing system, as recommended by the Grants Commission, absolutely fits criterion of fairness because, in effect, rich states, which Western Australia now is, more so than any other state in the Commonwealth, subsidise the poorer ones. Now, it's sometimes alleged, particularly by treasurers of New South Wales and Victoria, and by people who are commissioned by treasurers of New South Wales and Victoria to produce reports on fiscal equalisation, that the system of distribution of GST revenues among the states acts as a disincentive to the recipient states to improve their efficiency or to reform their economies. And I just don't think there's any evidence for that. It's tantamount to saying that having an income tax or having a progressive income tax system acts as a disincentive to people to get richer. And I don't think there's any evidence for that, and nor do I think there's any evidence to suggest that states which have been recipients, net beneficiaries of the Grants Commission arrangements have been any less enthusiastic about pursuing economic reform than states who have been contributors to it. I mean, as I say, Western Australia for most of the last 78 years has been a net recipient. It's now a substantial net contributor. But I don't think any Western Australian would suggest that their state has been unenthusiastic about economic reform, except maybe in a couple of areas like retail trade and wholesale potato marketing, you know, for reasons that continue to bemuse me every time I go to Perth. Certainly the poorer states have not improved their position. You know, Tasmania and South Australia have been at the bottom of the pack for a long time and they remain there. But I don't think that's because of the way in which the GST revenues are carved up among the states. I think that's for other reasons to do in part with the structure of their economies, partly to do with the ageing of their population, partly, especially in Tasmania's case, to do with the attitudes that people have to participating in education and the structure of the education system, and other aspects of bad state government. But I don't think it's a function of the distribution, the way in which the GST revenues are carved up by the states. It's certainly fair to say that the system is complex. And I'm certainly not opposed to reforms that would make the system less complex and more predictable, including for state treasuries to guess what they're going to get out of it. But beyond that, I think the fundamental principles that the Grants Commission has followed in recommending the distribution of GST revenues among the states since 1933, which are that each state and territory, by equal effort, should be able to raise revenue, and after taking account of differences in their capacity or in their requirements to fund services and the cost of them of providing them, ought to be able to provide services to their citizens of equivalent standard and quality. I think that's a pretty good principle for running a federation on.
Just last one on negative viewing. In terms of aspects of abolishing it or altering it, what would your views be on retrospectivity and grandfathering and the like? I mean, obviously grandfathering anything through a tax system adds to its complexity, but at the same time, if you've got people who have invested in costly properties with the negative gearing being capitalised into it, it's essentially changing the playing field on them. Well, what's your views on that?
Well, I certainly don't think taxes should be retrospective. End of story. Grandfathering arrangements, as you say, can be difficult and add to complexity of the tax system, and certainly the way in which, for example, successive changes in superannuation tax rules have been grandfathered have mightily added to the complexity of superannuation taxation arrangements. I would think, and you know, I'm sort of open to contrary opinions about this, that the right way to do that, if you abolish negative gearing, would be to say that would be to mandate some kind of revaluation at the point at which the law changes, and that henceforth, you know, capital gains from that point, you can accrue running losses associated with, for example, interest exceeding net rent against those, but that you can't carry forward losses from that point, losses from that period further, against subsequent capital gains, or if they did the Henry Review version of what's recommended, which is to keep it but to reduce the concession. In effect, what that's saying, as I understand the Henry Review recommendation, is that you could only deduct net losses at the same rate as the capital gains tax rate, rather than at the same rate as your personal income tax rate. So that seems to me to be quite fair. And yes, that results in a net loss for people who have entered into negatively geared arrangements some time ago, but in what way is that different, for example, from a decision by the government just to increase a marginal rate of tax? You know, I mean, governments do these sorts of things, and I think in the context of the mining tax debate, the term sovereign risk was much abused by people who participated in that. I mean, to me, sovereign risk is about the risk that a government confiscates your business. You know, it's not about the risk that a government may change the tax treatment of the income generated by that business, because governments do that all the time without that being described commonly as sovereign risk. And in the same way, I mean, while what I'm proposing and what the Henry Review is proposing would impose some losses on people who previously entered into negatively geared investment arrangements, governments do things that impose losses on people all the time. Now, it might be that they could compensate some of those simply by reducing marginal tax rates more broadly, you know, and I'm almost always in favour of tax reforms that entail broadening the base and lowering the rates. I think that's, in principle, a cardinal objective of good tax design, and that may be of some comfort to those people in those positions. But on the other hand, if people have been using a tax break that has no fundamental public policy objective behind it, and the government comes along and decides to remove it, well, that kind of thing happens.
Any others? We've probably got one more, if it's a quick one. That's it. Done.
Okay.
Thank you, George.
Yes, the text will go
up. It will go up on the website, so you can share it. It's words of wisdom are worth sharing, so. Thank you very much
for coming.
Thank you very much for the library.
So much detail.
You
always notice a few typos, right?
As always.
Very, very good. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Either of you to agree all of it, disagree with different bits of it.